This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, One More Heartbeat, Chosen to Receive God's Miracles. And the author is Carolyn Carter. And Carolyn joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview brought to you by Westbow Press. Hello, Carolyn.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us. And this is your story, an amazing story of faith and determination and literally great success in life, but not without its big challenges. And so I guess the reason you've written this book, let me share just a few things with everyone so everyone understands some of the things you're going to talk about in your book. One More Heartbeat is a story of God's grace to an undeserving believer, you write. I suffered many desperate moments of life, from the nerve-wracking worry over whether my marriage would survive to those sleepless nights wondering whether my rebellious son would ever return after running away from home, to the frightening time when a paralyzing accident left me with no vital signs for more than 20 minutes. You actually died. And obviously, that had a happy ending, because here you are. And of course, a lot of specifics with this. We're going to talk about the details. Carolyn, as you look back on everything kind of in general, and you look where you're at now, as you said, this is a story of God's grace. Does that sum it up?
That sums it up totally. It really sums it up, because my life has been like a growing experience. I've seen over my life that there were times that I didn't really trust God to do what He should do. I wanted to do it my way. And just through the events in my life, I've been able to turn everything over to Him and get rid of all the worry in my life.
Well, you start out talking about marrying a non-believer. Now, were you rooted in the faith at that moment in time?
Absolutely. I accepted Christ when I was 13, and I have always been a firm believer. I grew up in a Christian home. I had wonderful Christian parents, and I had what I would consider an ideal childhood. Never any real problems. We just coasted through life. Our family was happy. And when I met Gary, he was one of the greatest guys I've ever met. He was funny. He was very attentive to me. I wasn't impressed with him the first time I met him because he came to visit a friend of mine at a roadblock right after Hurricane Camille. And we were collecting money for the victims of Hurricane Camille. And when he walked up, he had on cut-off blue jeans that were cut off like shorts. They had raveled up so high that you could see the pockets. And I was just so embarrassed for him. I thought, he just doesn't understand what he looks like, and I wasn't impressed. But he called me a little bit later and asked me if I would go out. Very hesitantly, I went. And after that first date, we never dated anybody else. And I think I was working with my mind and my heart, not thinking about what I should be asking God for. Because after we got married, I really started to see the real Gary. He was not a Christian. He started to show a temper. He would throw things. I would worry about what I said because he would fuss at me. When I wanted to go to church on Sunday morning, his comment was, "Well, you must love that church more than you do me." And a non-believer doesn't understand that that's true, not the church, but God. You should always put Him first. And so I would go if he was in a good mood. I would stay at home if he wasn't. And this was true even after Chris, our first child, was born. And one Saturday, some friends of ours called and invited us to attend a small country church. And Gary was excited about it. I was not. I didn't think, I thought they didn't have a nursery. So I didn't know what we were going to do with one-year-old Chris, who was a very active child. But I went anyway, and it was a Presbyterian church. And that morning, the minister said, "I can't explain this. I've never, ever given an invitation, but I really feel like God is telling me that somebody here wants to come and accept him." So they offered an invitation, and Gary went down. And it was just such a neat experience. I'd been praying for him for 2 years, over 2 years, that he would accept Christ and that it could change his life and give him the joy that I had known since I was 13. And it totally changed our life. It totally changed his life. Friends of ours started to comment about the differences in his life, and my family started to comment about the differences in his life. And it really did change our life. I was afraid for a while that our marriage wouldn't work, but we've been married now for 41 years, and it just gets better all the time.
So miracles do happen.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And that was the first real miracle right. that I saw in my life.
And then, of course, you talk about your son, Chris, who was ADHD before the medical profession recognized this as a disease. So he had some real struggles in early life and came to a point where I guess he didn't care about school anymore.
Well, I don't think he did. I think Chris, after raising him and after being with him, I really realized that a lot of Chris's problems were rooted in the fact that he's a very smart child. And he always made straight A's, and he was frustrated with school. He was bored with school, and you combine that with ADHD, and that's not a good combination. And so his teachers, he would get in trouble because he could do his work so much quicker than the other children. And we were always at the school at a teacher-parent conference and talking about how we needed to calm Chris down. Well, we didn't know how to do that. We tried discipline. We tried taking, like, his toys away. We tried taking TV away, privileges away. And it seemed that nothing helped. And it was just mostly like being a mischievous little boy up until he got into junior high. We started to see more problems. And then in high school is when we really, really saw his frustration. And he exhibited that in just total rebellion. So we...
So he eventually ran away from home.
He did. He did. He came home from school the first semester of his junior year, and it was report card day. So his little brother gave me his report cards, and he had straight A's and B's. And then I said, "Chris, what about yours?" And, you know, in high school, they give him an individual slip for every class. And so he handed me those, and the first one was math, and it had F. Then English had F. Then all of his subjects, he had five F's. And I said, "Chris, you know, even a stupid person can make a D. You know, what happened?" And he said, "I showed him." Well, it went bad from there because he picked up his little brother and threw him against the wall and told him that he hated him because he was so smart. And then he started screaming at me, and he went in his room and slammed the door. Well, I called Gary and told him, "You need to come home. You know, this is getting out of hand." And when Gary got home, Chris got very aggressive with him and wanted to fight. And, of course, Gary wouldn't fight. But Chris did run away from home. And he took his little car and left. And he was gone for about 4 days. But I guess as a part of prayer, he went to Christian homes where his friends lived. Because Chris was raised in a church. I mean, we went to church all the time. And so the mom would call me, and she would say, "Chris doesn't know I'm calling you, but he's here." Well, after 4 days, I told that mom, I said, "He can't stay at your house any longer. So you need to just tell him you can stay here tonight, but you need to go back home tomorrow." Well, that scared me because I thought, I can't believe I just said that because I don't know where my child's going to go. But the phone rang in the middle of the night. And he said, "I'm coming home, but under my rules." And it's like one of those little 30-second prayers where you just say, okay, God, give me the words, because I didn't want to run my child off anymore. But I said, no, Chris, if you come home, it's under our conditions. And he hung up the phone, and I thought I had lost him. But about 2 hours later, I heard the front door open and close, and he came in. We decided at that point that the only solution was to send him to military school. And that definitely turned his life around. So that was another, and we didn't have the money for it. The day after we had his interview, my dad called, and he said, Carolyn, I need to talk to you. Can you come down here? Well, I did. He said, the strangest thing happened. This man came to the door, and he said, you took out an insurance policy on yourself when your children were little, and it's been in the file, and it's been paid up for all these years. I want to let you know that you can either leave it and give them the benefits when you die, or you can cash it in now, and they can have the money now. When he told me the amount, it was exactly the amount we needed for Chris to go to military school, because we needed $16,500 for his tuition and uniforms and everything. That's exactly the amount that the insurance policy was. So that's big miracle number two.
Well, that's certainly a huge, huge weight when a child is struggling and you don't know what's going to happen. But, of course, you had a life-changing, near-fatal medical situation. Just give us a few of those details.
Well, I was walking out of my door with our youngest son's girlfriend, and I was going to take her to the doctor. When I got to the bottom of the steps in the driveway, I stepped on a garden hose and twisted my ankle and fell. And I thought I had just sprained my ankle. I didn't realize how bad it was. So she went in and got Gary, and he took us to the doctor. When they x-rayed, I had broken my right leg, and three of the metatarsal bones in my left foot was in cast on both legs. I was totally immobile, and I'm not that kind of person. I don't sit for very long. And I had to be in a wheelchair all the time or in the bed. As a result of that, after 2 weeks, I threw a clot from my right leg, the break in my leg, and had a severe pulmonary embolism. And it stopped all vital signs for over 20 minutes. By the time my ambulance got to my house, I had stopped breathing. And they did chest compressions and a breathing bag and for over 20 minutes. And the emergency room doctor kept saying, this is it. We need to call it. But I was very blessed that one of our dear friends, who is a pulmonologist here in Oxford, was on call that night. And he said, I just can't go out there and tell my friend Gary that I've lost his wife. I can't give up. And he kept on with the chest compressions and the breathing bag, and my heart started again. But they still told my family that I probably would be without any memory, I probably would be in a constant vegetative state, that I really needed constant care, that they needed to find a place for me to live. And as a miracle from God, within 8 days, I was out of the hospital. I was not totally well at that point. I required physical therapy for about 6 months, and I still was in a wheelchair. I required voice therapy for over a year because when they were trying to intubate me, they tore up all my vocal cords. So I was kind of a mess for a little while, and it took me a while to get my memory back. But as you can see, I hope, just talking to you, the Lord has really restored everything. And it totally changed my life because the little things I used to worry about, I don't worry about anymore. Well, you know, I know the bigger picture now. And I actually was fortunate enough to spend a little time with God, because while my family and the doctors were in total turmoil and trauma, I was in the arms of God at that point. And I just remember it so well that I have no fear of dying. And that's been beneficial because I can counsel with people that have someone in their family that is at death's door, I can reassure them, if they're a Christian, what they're going to see in just a little while.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left. Just kind of give us some of the things you've been able to achieve. You've got, after decades in the jewelry business, and you had your own jewelry store, you got back into teaching, and you've had some great success.
Well, I really did. And see, I think this is, I had my degree already when we went into the jewelry store. So when we sold our jewelry store, I immediately started to teach. And God really did bless me. And I think He used my experience with a rebellious child during that time. He used my maturity and my skills in just running the jewelry store. I taught math. And as a result of that, I was chosen as one of 10 teachers to do a cultural educational exchange in Madrid, Spain, an all-expense-paid trip for 8 days to Madrid, where we toured schools and shared ideas with their teachers. We toured, of course, all the beautiful architecture over there. And then in 2006, I was chosen as the Teacher of the Year at my school. And then in 2009, I was chosen as the Renaissance Learning Model Classroom Teacher, and that's a national award. So I really feel like those were the blessings that God gave me for being obedient and for learning to depend on Him a little bit more.
We've been talking with Carolyn Carter. She is the author of her book, One More Heartbeat, Chosen to Receive God's Miracles. Carolyn, tell us how to get your book.
Well, right now you can get it on Barnes & Noble or Amazon. They have it in hardback, paperback, and they do have the e-books available. Or you can get it from Westbow Press.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you. I have really enjoyed talking with you.
This interview has been brought to everyone by Westbow Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on TogiNet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out her website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on TogiNet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Colors for Life, a workbook. And the author is Martha Soria Sears. And Martha joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Martha.
Hello, Steve.
Well, you're going to take us on a coloring journey, if I could put it that way. Most people, I don't think, would think the first thing to deal with stress is to color. I don't think that would come to their mind, would it? But you have discovered through many, 40 years of discovery that these techniques really work, don't they?
Absolutely, yes. And not only do they not have to be complicated, but they can also be fun.
Ah.
And actually, you know, the more simple and fun they are, I have found, the more effective they are.
Interesting. Well, you say this book is about self-discovery through coloring. It offers coloring exercises that teach you to translate that internal dialogue and use it for improving yourself in your life. Well, that's something that needs to be explained, but you talk about aura energy, graphology, symbolism, inner child dialogue. This, obviously, this is, you know, principles and discovery, if you will, that we don't think about very often, do we? Or maybe probably most of us don't think about it at all. How did you discover this?
Well, sure. I have been a student of metaphysics and the power of the mind and different self-improvement techniques for 40 years. And, you know, in my working as a spiritual counselor for people, I often learned from them as to what would work to help ease their pain, their troubles, and bring about not just release and healing, but also actually help them improve in their own life. And I always took away from my working sessions with them ideas of how to package, you know, these techniques up so that they could be available to, you know, to others.
You witnessed a child coloring one day.
Ah, yes, that's a wonderful. That is exactly, if I was to say, the starting point of this technique. I was a spiritual counselor for a group of women who had escaped domestic violence and other traumas in their personal life and were putting their lives back together. And these were professional women that were trying to get back into their career, and some of them had children. So I was working with one of these women, and her son was in the living room, and as she was making tea for us, I was observing him, and all of a sudden, he must have remembered something or, you know, felt something. He got up, he got really angry, he started kicking his toys and throwing them around, and he just seemed sad and angry. And then he came across his coloring book and his crayons, and he picked it up and fell to his knees and looked for a page to color on, picked up a color, and just started scratching away. I mean, he was so intense about it. And then he finished. He stood up, looked at it with, you know, a bit of satisfaction, and then got a smile on his face, went out and played with his friends in the backyard. And so that was what my physical eyes were seeing, but my ability to read auras and see colors around people gave me another data point that I took into consideration, and that is that as I observed his aura, I could see the dark red swirling around, which was the anger and the frustration and the sadness. And as he was coloring, I could see that color venting from his aura and allowing him to be in a more peaceful, healthy place. So I put that kind of in, you know, in the back of my mind, and I knew I had just witnessed something very important, but didn't quite know how I was going to apply it, what it was going to become, but I knew it was important. And then a few weeks later, another woman from this support group that I worked with called me, and you know, she was very troubled because she, again, these were professional women, you know, lawyers, business managers, etc. And every week she had a very important meeting with the partners of her firm. And most of them were male, you know, typical strong businessmen, alpha males, if you will. And She had found herself getting more and more anxious every week before she went into this meeting, and she was saying, "Martha, I really need a technique to help me because so far nothing's helped. I've meditated, I've done other things, and nothing's helping." And I remembered that, that scene with the young boy coloring away, and I said, "You know, we've tried everything else. Let's try something totally new and just, you know, off the wall, if you will." And I said, "Before you go to the meeting, you know, tomorrow, get a coloring book, take some crayons, and right before the meeting, for a few minutes, just color whatever you want. It's not about a pretty picture. It's just use the crayons as your expression on the page, and let that crayon take your, you know, your fear, your anxiety, your stress. Just pour it onto the page." So that later that day, later after she had had the meeting, later in the week, she called me and she said, "Oh my goodness, that was wonderful. I did exactly what you said, and I went into that meeting, and there was no baggage. I felt strong. I felt at peace. I was me, the old me, you know." And so it's like there's another data point. And so started a journey of 20 years of observing different people from all walks of life with all different types of challenges that they were working through, and utilizing, through trial and error, different techniques with coloring. And then here we are.
You talk a lot about stress. You call it the source of all evil. You say unmanaged stress is the source of so much physical and emotional pain and suffering. So this is managing it or releasing it some way. This is obviously out of the box.
Yep, it is. It is essentially giving you a pressure valve by which you can release not just stress, but other, you know, emotions that are getting in the way. Or sometimes it's not even releasing. Sometimes it's opening up to your creative way of thinking. But it is definitely a technique for managing stress, because I do feel that unmanaged stress is the source of a lot of pain in our lives, whether it be physical, emotional, it gets in the way of us thinking straight. It makes us feel tired and, we don't feel good, right? So having techniques such as this that can provide that pressure valve, that can provide an outlet or a release for some of these emotions that really aren't helping us, then we can open the door to being able to be clear about what we need to do, to think more clearly, to feel more clearly, to be more receptive to answers, like, you know, problem solving and understanding our path. All of that is right behind that wall of stress or other unmanaged emotions.
I see in your book you have section 2, coloring exercises, and you've leafed through these pages, and here's a you call it a mystic hand, and then there's another one called sledgehammer and brick wall, and another one life's compass, a tree of life, sunrise, sunset, and the list goes on. Now, these are pictures to color.
Yes, they are. Each diagram or each picture has a particular intent. And again, this has been through observation, through working with clients, and seeing what symbolism, this is where the symbolism comes in. What symbolism gets you to a particular frame of mind. So, for example, the tree. You know, a lot of cultures consider the tree your heritage, you know, your lineage. So, of course, if we follow that train of thought, then, you know, what is the root of your concerns, of your focus, of your stress? And the top of the tree, the branches, where is it that you're trying to reach to? You know, how are you trying to build your own, contribution to that lineage and that heritage? So each of the symbols, each of the diagrams have certain symbology. And that's where the title comes from. And the reason why the diagrams or the pictures are so simple, if you will, almost childlike, if you will, is because I found that the simpler, even almost the rougher the diagram was, the easier it was for people to get into the exercise. And because we are thinking human beings and analytical in many ways, the more complicated or more beautiful this diagram was, the more they got into the art of it. And this is not an artistic exercise, right? So they would try to think about, oh, that's a beautiful peacock, and it's got an exotic, you know, fan of feathers. And it's like, okay, now you're way off. That's not what the purpose of this was. So bringing back to basics, if you will, bringing it back to symbols that we've grown up with in our cultures, in our variety of cultures, that already have a certain certain meaning for us. And that's why these diagrams are, again, very simple and almost childlike, because that's what we're reaching into.
I also see in Section 3, which is titled Translation Guides. Now, is this an explanation or to help us better understand what we're doing? Because each section there, or title of each chapter, is the same as the coloring exercise.
Exactly, right. So the technique goes as follows. You pick a diagram or a picture based on what it is that you're trying to accomplish. And let's take, for example, the brick wall with the hammer. You're trying to solve a problem. You're trying to have a breakthrough, if you will. So you see how there's already a connotation or association with what the picture is. You're trying to break through and solve something. You before you get into Section 3, you just do the exercise of picking out a color and whatever attracts you, and coloring, not even worrying about are you making a pretty picture, because that's not the intent, but just letting yourself be completely free with how you color it, where you color, what colors you use, what strokes you use. After you finish, then you go to Section 3, and the section provides a guide by which you can understand what it is that you have been expressing through color. So, for example, the first part of that section explains that the type of stroke that you use has already given you some data points to what it is that you're trying to communicate with yourself. And this is where graphology comes in. You know, if you have a very sharp stroke or a very heavy stroke, obviously there is some stress or strong emotion behind that, because in some exercises with clients, I can even run my hand behind the page and feel a bump. That's how strong they've been coloring. And obviously there's something behind that. Other times there's very light strokes, and almost timid strokes. That tells us something. So the translation allows you to understand what you are expressing through the type of stroke, where you started coloring. Did you start at a particular piece of the picture? And what colors you used. So everything comes into that translation. An example with the brick wall, if you decided to put a crack in the wall, that's very symbolic. That means that you already found something that is about to bring you that breakthrough. So we analyze in the translation what that crack in the wall, what color did you draw it? Did you start with the crack, or did you draw the crack after you finished coloring? Again, it's all data points, and then that you can bring together and understand the messages that you have been trying to give yourself through that internal dialogue, but maybe have not understood. And that's what this is. It's trying to get you to understand that information that you're trying to share with yourself.
We have about a minute left. Why don't you just share with us some concluding thoughts?
Sure. I really think that being able to utilize techniques that are simple and fun is a wonderful way to accomplish self-healing and breakthroughs in our ability to make our life better, solve our problems. And I think that having fun while doing it is a big part of that. So I hope that people enjoy these new techniques that I've developed and the coloring exercises.
The title of the book is Colors for Life, a Workbook. Martha, tell us how to get your book.
Sure. So the book is by Balboa Press, and they do have their website. In addition to that, my company also sells the book, and my company can be reached at www.nsandnancysandsamtransformation.com. And you can also find it on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. So it's out there, and whatever is most convenient, that book is available.
Well, thank you very much, Martha, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure.
This interview has been brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing. And we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show. Every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles. And then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, leahjansen.com. That's Leah, LEAHJANTZEN.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen and listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole O'Dell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole O'Dell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Derailed, a Memoir, and the author is Jerry Tanner, and Jerry joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, how you doing?
Well, this is a saga, as you put it, of a highly successful businessman brought down by mere allegations of misconduct and his subsequent confrontation with an American legal system that categorically denied him a fair trial. And this is your story.
Yes, it is.
You also say it's a powerful commentary on the hypocrisy of an American society founded on the principles of equality and tolerance, yet steeped in institutionalized prejudice and a stinging indictment of our system of courts and jurisprudence. Well, that is a lot to cover, but this is fact.
Yes, it is.
Well, let's back up here, Jerry. You also say you found yourself entangled in a legal battle over allegations of sexual assault brought on by the sons of an evangelical pastor. You're a gay man and successful in business, and you feel you just didn't fit in. Is that it?
Yes, exactly what it is, or exactly what it was. what transpired. Here I can get a fair trial. It was in the Matsu Burl in Alaska, which is Wasilla. And it's a Bible Belt, and you just couldn't get a fair trial.
Well, let's find out a couple of things. Tell us, Jerry, this is a lot of controversy. I'm sure there's a lot of pain in here, personal, emotional pain. Why did you decide to publish the book?
To let people know what transpires, but also hopefully it avoids someone else in the same spectrum that I went through. Do not let your guard down. Be very aware of your surroundings at all times.
Now, let's go back. When did this happen?
The allegations transpired in 2005, and they brought charges against me in 2007. And I fought as long as I could against it, but they won.
And so was this a criminal or civil kind of lawsuit?
It turned to criminal.
So now tell us about starting this health company. You're a very successful entrepreneur.
Well, I started the company back in 99. I was the first employee. I seen there was a need. So I ventured out, and I turned a one-man show into a 900-employee company and was doing over $20 million a year revenue.
And you also say you took over a corrupt, bankrupt mail-order pharmacy.
Yes.
That's part of this roller coaster.
Yes, that was in Maine, and it was mismanaged. There was some corruption in there. Took over a bankrupt mail-order pharmacy, and in 1 year turned it into a $30 million company.
So obviously the facts are very clear. You know what you're doing business-wise.
In some areas, you know, like anybody, you're intelligent and smart in some areas, and you can be very naive in others.
How did this all happen with these allegations of a sexual assault?
Well, what transpired was I was in a committed relationship for 18 years, and we was having some serious problems. And an opportunity came up, and it was mutual, and it was two adults. And all of a sudden, it turned into money and allegations, and that's exactly what transpired in a nutshell without going into too much detail.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of this situation was about money.
Yes.
The really bottom line issue.
Yeah, money. And the other thing was to get me out of the healthcare business because I was competition, and the thing of it is, Alaska is the last frontier, but in a lot of ways, they're still redneck, and a gay entrepreneur should not be that successful and have that much clout and stuff in the business world.
So you're claiming and have stood on this personal fact that with this son of a, well, I guess it was the sons of an evangelical pastor, they're the ones that brought this these allegations, but it's really about the intolerant religious right. Is that what your whole point is?
Yeah, and it's basically what it is. I think what it boils down to is the pastor didn't want to admit that their son was possibly gay or has anything like that, and it was like all my fault. I'm the one that done it and everything, and it wasn't like that.
And all of that came out in the trial?
A lot of it came out. There was, I mean, a lot of different things transpired there. And it just, in a nutshell, I always believed in the judicial system. I know the wheels move very slowly. But I thought the truth would come out and everything would be fine for me. But that wasn't the case. And I found out that prejudice and unfair justice is very real, and it's very much well and alive in this country. Also, my attorney has tried to get the venue changed out of the Matsu Borough into Anchorage, and that was even denied to me.
So overcoming the image of being a gay man was just too much for this community.
Yeah, in a nutshell. And they made me out to be a barbaric. The news media had a heyday with it, too, because I was very successful. So basically, I hit front page.
Right. So when you talk about community and what that means to you, how do you describe a community to you today?
Well, community to me is a bunch of people who live in the community. They do what's best. They network. They help those who cannot help themselves. And you make your community a better place to live for all people, just not some, but all. And that's my interpretation of community.
So the legal system not being fair to you from your point of view, is this just something to unique you feel to your situation, or is it in general?
I don't think it's unique to me. I think it's in general. Because if you look around the country in certain aspects, in different geographic areas, look what's going on. And look at the persecution and the unjust. And it's very much a well and alive and everything. But it's not brought to the forefront unless it's something major.
Are you still in the healthcare business?
No, I'm not.
So you lost your business?
Yes. The state of Alaska wouldn't let me be in the business.
Lost your license?
Yes.
And no recourse, no appeals or anything like that?
I'm checking to see what options I have and everything at this point to see what I can do and what is feasible.
So when you look at this term that we hear a lot in the news about equality, how do you respond to that?
To me, it's words. The mainstream, how they look at it, as long as you don't bring it to the forefront, it's not in their face, it's okay. But as soon as you want equality and you bring it to the forefront, they throw the G card to you, which is God, and unjust and everything. And it's very much a real, it's a reality. It's not make-believe. And it's real reality, and it's there. And you can see it in all aspects of life. Prime example, I'll give you an example. Gay marriage, you know, to me, I don't see what the issue is. And if you look at the statistics and everything else, there shouldn't even be an issue. But it is an issue.
So where do you go from here? Has this become a crusade?
The thing is, I learned a long time ago, you pick your battles and you pick them wisely. And in a way, you want to say it's a crusade, but you pick your battles and you deal with facts, not fiction. And you go on there. It's like anything. You have to crawl before you walk. And it's a lengthy process, and it's not going to happen overnight. But by giving people awareness, let them know what's going on and everything, and giving them the facts. And the fact of the matter is there's at least two sides to a story. Sometimes there's three or four. If people have the knowledge and the facts, they can make an intelligent decision. And that's what I'm trying to do, get the information out there so they can come to their own conclusion.
Are there others who have united with you to join you in this cause?
I am networking at this time. To see what's available. I'm networking. I'm giving some talks. I'm talking to other people and everything and going from there. And, you know, an ideal turns into momentum, but like anything, it takes time. And I have plenty of time, and that's what I'm doing.
So Derailed, this memoir, details this journey and this fight.
Yes. And also the fight that I had just through life. And the thing of it is, I'm not the only one who has experienced this. Other people have experienced this and stuff. People have experienced injustice, and also, and everybody's life is not perfect. But I feel by putting myself and my story out there on the line, it can help someone else and let them know they're not alone. It does happen. It's out there, especially when I wrote the memoir, so other people know they're not alone. And yes, this does happen.
Jerry, we have time for some closing thoughts. Would you like to add anything that onto what we've already discussed?
The only thing I can, in closing, is tell people to be very aware of their surroundings, who their friends are, ask questions, and don't leave yourself vulnerable at any time. It's terrible to say, but it's the facts.
The title of the book, Derailed, a Memoir, and the author is Jerry Tanner. Jerry, tell us how to get your book.
You can buy it at Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, and from Balboa Press.
Well, thank you, Jerry. Thanks for being with us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you.
And this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Thanks again, Jerry.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.